He didn't want to be in that elevator if the car stalled between Tartarus and the mortal world. "If we do push the button for 12 minutes, Percy said, "and the chains are cut..."
"The door should reset," Bob said. "That is what they are supposed to do. They will disappear from Tartarus. They will appear somewhere else, where Gia cannot use them."
"Thanatos can reclaim them," Annabeth said. "Death goes back to normal, and the monsters lose their shortcut to the mortal world."
Percy exhaled.
"Easy peasy. Except for, well, everything."
Small Bob purred.
"I will push the button," Bob volunteered.
A mix of feelings churned in Percy's gut. Grief, sadness, gratitude, and guilt thickening into emotional cement.
"Bob, we can't ask you to do that. You want to go through the doors too. You want to see the sky again and the stars and..."
"I would like that," Bob agreed. "But someone must push the button, and once the chains are cut, my brethren will fight to stop your passage. They will not want the doors to disappear."
Percy gazed at the endless horde of monsters. Even if he let Bob make this sacrifice, how could one Titan defend himself against so many for 12 minutes, all while keeping his finger on a button? The cement settled in Percy's stomach. He had always suspected how this would end. He would have to stay behind. While Bob fended off the army, Percy would hold the elevator button and make sure Annabeth got to safety. Somehow, he had to convince her to go without him. As long as she was safe and the doors disappeared, he could die knowing he'd done something right.
"Percy?"
Annabeth stared at him, a suspicious edge to her voice. She was too smart. If he met her eyes, she would see exactly what he was thinking.
"First things first," he said. "Let's cut those chains."
Chapter 64. Percy.
"Iapetus!" Hyperion bellowed. "Well, well! I thought you were hiding under a cleaning bucket somewhere."
Bob lumbered forward, scowling.
"I was not hiding."
Percy crept toward the right side of the doors. Annabeth sneaked toward the left. The Titans gave no sign of noticing them, but Percy took no chances. He kept Riptide in pen form. He crouched low, stepping as quietly as possible. The lesser monsters kept a respectful distance from the Titans, so there was enough empty space to maneuver around the doors. But Percy was keenly aware of the snarling mob at his back. Annabeth had decided to take the side Hyperion was guarding, on the theory that Hyperion was more likely to sense Percy. After all, Percy was the last one to have killed him in the mortal world. That was fine with Percy. After being in Tartarus for so long, he could barely look at Hyperion's burning golden armor without getting spots in his eyes. On Percy's side of the doors, Krios stood dark and silent, his ram's-headed helmet covering his face. He kept one foot planted on the chain's anchor and his thumb on the up button. Bob faced his brethren. He planted his spear and tried to look as fierce as possible with a kitten on his shoulder.
"Hyperion and Krios, I remember you both."
"Do you, Iapetus?"
The golden Titan laughed, glancing at Krios to share the joke.
"Well, that's good to know. I heard Percy Jackson turned you into a brainwashed scullery maid. What did he rename you? Betty?"
"Bob,"
snarled Bob.
"Well, it's about time you showed up, Bob. Krios and I have been stuck here for weeks."
"Hours,"
Krios corrected, his voice a deep rumble inside his helmet.
"Whatever," Hyperion said. "It's boring work, guarding these doors, shuffling monsters through at Gia's orders. Krios,
What's our next group, anyway?
Double Red, said Krios.
Hyperion sighed. The flames glowed hotter across his shoulders.
Double Red. Why do we go from A-22 to Double Red? What kind of system is that?
He glared at Bob.
This is no job for me, the Lord of Light, Titan of the East, Master of Dawn. Why am I forced to wait in the darkness while the giants go into battle and get all the glory? Now, Krios, I can understand.
I get all the worst assignments, Krios muttered,
his thumb still on the button.
But me? Hyperion said. Ridiculous! This should be your job, Iapetus. Here, take my place for a while.
Bob stared at the doors, but his gaze was distant, lost in the past.
The four of us held down our father Uranos, he remembered. Koyos and me, and the two of you. Kronos promised us mastery of the four corners of the earth for helping with the murder.
Indeed, Hyperion said, and I was happy to do it. I would have wielded the scythe myself if I'd had the chance. But you, Bob, you were always conflicted about that killing, weren't you? The soft titan of the West, soft as the sunset. Why our parents named you the Piercer, I will never know. More like the Whimper.
Percy reached the anchor hook. He uncapped his pen and Riptide grew to full length. Krios didn't react. His attention was firmly fixed on Bob, who had just leveled the point of his spear at Hyperion's chest.
I can still pierce, Bob said,
his voice low and even.
You brag too much, Hyperion. You are bright and fiery, but Percy Jackson defeated you anyway. I hear you became a nice tree in Central Park.
Hyperion's eyes smoldered.
Careful, brother.
At least a janitor's work is honest, Bob said. I clean up after others. I leave the palace better than I found it. But you do not care what messes you make. You followed Kronos blindly. Now you take orders from Gia.
She is our mother, Hyperion bellowed.
She did not wake for our war on Olympus, Bob recalled. She favors her second brood, the giants.
Krios grunted.
That's true enough. The children of the pit.
Both of you hold your tongues.
Hyperion's voice was tinged with fear.
You never know when he is listening.
The elevator dinged. All three titans jumped. Had it been 12 minutes? Percy had lost track of time. Krios took his finger off the button and called out,
Double Red? Where is Double Red?
Hordes of monsters stirred and jostled one another, but none of them came forward. Krios heaved a sigh.
I told them to hang on to their tickets. Double Red, you'll lose your place in the queue.
Annabeth was in position, right behind Hyperion. She raised her Drakenbone sword over the base of the chains. In the fiery light of the Titan's armor, her death mist disguise made her look like a burning ghoul. She held up three fingers, ready to count down. They had to cut the chains before the next group tried to take the elevator, but they also had to make sure the Titans were as distracted as possible. Hyperion muttered a curse.
Just wonderful! This will completely mess up our schedule.
He sneered at Bob.
Make your choice, brother. Fight us or help us. I don't have time for your lectures.
Bob glanced at Annabeth and Percy. Percy thought he might start a fight, but instead he raised the point of his spear.
Very well. I will take guard duty. Which of you wants a break first?
Me, of course.
Hyperion said.
Me,
Krios snapped.
I've been holding that button so long, my thumb is going to fall off.
I've been standing here longer, Hyperion grumbled. You two guard the doors while I go up to the mortal world. I have some Greek heroes to wreak vengeance upon.
Oh no, Krios complained. That Roman boy is on his way to Epirus, the one who killed me on Mount Othrys. Got lucky he did. Now it's my turn.
Bah! Hyperion drew his sword. I'll cut you first, ramhead!
Krios raised his own blade.
You can try, but I won't be stuck in this stinking pit any longer.
Annabeth caught Percy's eyes. She mouthed, one, two. Before he could strike the chains, a high-pitched whine pierced his ears, like the sound of an incoming rocket. Percy just had time to think, uh-oh. Then an explosion rocked the hillside. A wave of heat knocked Percy backward. Dark shrapnel ripped through Krios and Hyperion, shredding them as easily as wood in a chipper.
Stinking pit.
A hollow voice rolled across the plains, shaking the warm, fleshy ground. Bob staggered to his feet. Somehow, the explosion hadn't touched him. He swept his spear in front of him, trying to locate the source of the voice. Small Bob the kitten crawled into his coveralls. Annabeth had landed about 20 feet from the doors. When she stood, Percy was so relieved she was alive it took him a moment to realize she looked like herself. The death mist had evaporated. He looked at his own hands. His disguise was gone too.
Titans, said the voice disdainfully. Lesser beings, imperfect and weak.
In front of the doors of death, the air darkened and solidified. The being who appeared was so massive, radiating such pure malevolence, that Percy wanted to crawl away and hide. Instead, he forced his eyes to trace the god's form, starting with his black iron boots, each one as large as a coffin. His legs were covered in dark greaves, his flesh all thick purple muscle like the ground. His armored skirt was made from thousands of blackened, twisted bones, woven together like chain links, and clasped in place by a belt of interwoven, monstrous arms. On the surface of the warrior's breastplate, murky faces appeared and submerged. Giants, cyclopes, gorgons, and drakens, all pressing against the armor as if trying to get out. The warrior's arms were bare, muscular, purple, and glistening. His hands as large as crane scoops. Worst of all was his head. A helmet of twisted rock and metal with no particular shape, just jagged spikes and pulsing patches of magma. His entire face was a whirlpool, an inward spiral of darkness. As Percy watched, the last particles of Titan essence from Hyperion and Krios were vacuumed into the warrior's maw. Somehow, Percy found his voice.
Tartarus.
The warrior made a sound like a mountain cracking in half. A roar or a laugh, Percy couldn't be sure.
This form is only a small manifestation of my power, said the god. But it is enough to deal with you. I do not interfere lightly, little demigod. It is beneath me to deal with gnats such as yourself.
Percy's
legs threatened to collapse under him.
Don't, you know, go to any trouble.
You have proven surprisingly resilient, Tartarus said. You have come too far. I can no longer stand by and watch your progress.
Tartarus spread his arms. Throughout the valley, thousands of monsters wailed and roared, clashing their weapons and bellowing in triumph. The doors of death shuddered in their chains.
"Be honored, little demigods," said the god of the pit. "Even the Olympians were never worthy of my personal attention. But you will be destroyed by Tartarus himself."
Chapter 65. Frank. Frank was hoping for fireworks, or at least a big sign that read, "Welcome home." More than 3,000 years ago, his Greek ancestor, good old Periclymenus the Shapeshifter, had sailed east with the Argonauts. Centuries later, Periclymenus's descendants had served in the Eastern Roman legions. Then, through a series of misadventures, the family had ended up in China, finally immigrating to Canada in the 20th century. Now, Frank was back in Greece, which meant that the Zhang family had completely circled the globe. That seemed like cause for celebration, but the only welcoming committee was a flock of wild, hungry harpies who attacked the ship. Frank felt kind of bad as he shot them down with his bow. He kept thinking of Ella, their freakishly smart harpy friend from Portland. But these harpies weren't Ella. They gladly would have chewed Frank's face off, so he blasted them into clouds of dust and feathers. The Greek landscape below was just as inhospitable. The hills were strewn with boulders and stunted cedars, all shimmering in the hazy air. The sun beat down, as if trying to hammer the countryside into a celestial bronze shield. Even from 100 feet up, Frank could hear the drone of cicadas buzzing in the trees, a sleepy, otherworldly sound that made his eyes heavy. Even the dueling voices of the war god inside his head seemed to have dozed off. They had hardly bothered Frank at all since the crew had crossed into Greece. Sweat trickled down his neck. After being frozen below deck by that crazy snow goddess, Frank had thought he would never feel warm again. But now, the back of his shirt was soaked.
"Hot and steamy," Leo grinned at the helm. "Makes me homesick for Houston. What do you say, Hazel? All we need now are some giant mosquitoes and it'll feel just like the Gulf Coast."
"Thanks a lot, Leo," Hazel grumbled. "We'll probably get attacked by ancient Greek mosquito monsters now."
Frank studied the two of them, quietly marveling how the tension between them had disappeared. Whatever had happened to Leo during his 5 days of exile, it had changed him. He still joked around, but Frank sensed something different about him, like a ship with a new keel. Maybe you couldn't see the keel, but you could tell it was there by the way the ship cut through the waves. Leo didn't seem so intent on teasing Frank. He chatted more easily with Hazel, not stealing those wistful, mooning glances that had always made Frank uncomfortable. Hazel had diagnosed the problem privately to Frank.
"He met someone."
Frank was incredulous.
"How? Where? How could you possibly know?"
Hazel smiled.
"I just do."
As if she were a child of Venus rather than Pluto. Frank didn't get it. Of course, he was relieved that Leo wasn't hitting on his girl. But Frank was also kind of worried about Leo. Sure, they'd had their differences, but after all they'd been through together, Frank didn't want to see Leo get his heart broken.
"There!"
Nico's voice shook Frank out of his thoughts. As usual, D'Angelo was perched atop the foremast. He pointed toward a glittering green river snaking through the hills, a kilometer away.
"Maneuver us that way. We're close to the temple. Very close."
As if to prove his point, black lightning ripped through the sky,
leaving dark spots before Frank's eyes and making the hairs on his arms stand up. Jason strapped on his sword belt.
Everyone arm yourself. Leo, get us close, but don't land. No more contact with the ground than necessary. Piper, Hazel, get the mooring ropes.
On it, Piper said. Hazel gave Frank a peck on the cheek and ran to help.
Frank, Jason called. Get below and find Coach Hedge.
Yep.
He climbed downstairs and headed for Hedge's cabin. As he neared the door, he slowed down. He didn't want to surprise the satyr with any loud noises. Coach Hedge had a habit of jumping into the gangway with his baseball bat if he thought attackers were on board. Frank had almost gotten his head taken off a couple of times on his way to the bathroom. He raised his hand to knock. Then he realized the door was cracked open. He heard Coach Hedge talking inside.
Come on, babe, the satyr said. You know it's not like that.
Frank froze. He didn't mean to eavesdrop, but he wasn't sure what to do. Hazel had mentioned being worried about the coach. She'd insisted something was bothering him, but Frank hadn't thought much of it until now. He'd never heard the coach talk so gently. Usually, the only sounds Frank heard from the coach's cabin were sporting events on the TV, or the coach yelling, "Yeah, get 'em!" as he watched his favorite martial arts movies. Frank was pretty sure the coach wouldn't be calling Chuck Norris babe. Another voice spoke, female, but barely audible, like it was coming from a long way away.
I will, Coach Hedge promised, but, we're going into battle.
He cleared his throat.
And it may get ugly. You just stay safe. I'll get back. Honest.
Frank couldn't stand it anymore. He knocked loudly.
Hey, coach?
The talking stopped. Frank counted to six. The door flew open. Coach Hedge stood there scowling, his eyes bloodshot, like he'd been watching too much TV. He wore his usual baseball cap and gym shorts, with a leather cuirass over his shirt and a whistle hanging from his neck, maybe in case he wanted to call a foul against the monster armies.
Jong, what do you want?
We're getting ready for battle. We need you above deck.
The coach's goatee quivered.
Yeah, course you do.
He sounded strangely unexcited about the prospect of a fight.
I heard you talking, Frank stammered. Were you sending an iris message?
Hedge looked like he might smack Frank in the face, or at least blow the whistle really loud. Then his shoulders slumped. He heaved a sigh and turned inside, leaving Frank standing awkwardly in the doorway. The coach plopped down on his berth. He cupped his chin in his hand and stared glumly around his cabin. The place looked like a college dorm room after a hurricane. The floor strewn with laundry, maybe for wearing, maybe for snacks. It was hard to tell with satyrs. DVDs and dirty dishes scattered around the TV on the dresser. Every time the ship tilted, a mismatched herd of sports equipment rolled across the floor. Footballs, basketballs, baseballs, and for some reason, a single billiard ball. Tufts of goat hair floated through the air and collected under the furniture in clumps. Dust goats? Goat bunnies? On the coach's nightstand sat a bowl of water, a stack of golden drachmas, a flashlight, and glass prism for making rainbows. The coach had obviously come prepared to make a lot of iris messages. Frank remembered what Piper had told him about the coach's cloud nymph girlfriend who worked for Piper's dad. What was the girlfriend's name? Melinda? Millicent? No, Melly.
Is your girlfriend Melly all right?
Frank ventured.
None of your business, the coach snapped.
Okay.
Hedge rolled his eyes.
Fine. If you must know, yes, I was talking to Melly, but she's not my girlfriend anymore.
Oh.
Frank's heart sank.
You broke up?
No, you dolt. We got married. She's my wife.
Frank would have been less stunned if the coach had smacked him.
Coach, that's great. When, how?
None of your business,
he yelled again.
All right.
End of May, the coach said, just before the Argo 2 sailed. We didn't want to make a big deal out of it.
Frank felt like the ship was tilting again, but it must have been just him. The herd of wild sports equipment stayed put against the far wall. All this time the coach had been married? In spite of being a newlywed, he'd agreed to come on this quest. No wonder Hedge made so many calls back home. No wonder he was so cranky and belligerent. Still, Frank sensed there was more going on. The coach's tone during the Iris message made it sound like they were discussing a problem.
I didn't mean to eavesdrop, Frank said. But is she okay?
It was a private conversation.
Yeah, you're right.
Fine, I'll tell you.
Hedge plucked some fur off his thigh and let it float through the air.
She took a break from her job in L.A., went to Camp Half-Blood for the summer, because we figured...
His voice cracked.
We figured it would be safer. Now she's stuck there with the Romans about to attack. She's pretty scared.
Frank became very aware of the Centurion badge on his shirt, the SPQR tattoo on his forearm.
Sorry, he murmured. But if she's a cloud spirit, couldn't she just, you know, float away?
The coach curled his fingers around the grip of his baseball bat.
Normally, yeah. But see, she's in a delicate condition. It wouldn't be safe.
A delicate...
Frank's eyes widen.
She's going to have a baby? You're going to be a dad?
Shout it a little louder, Hedge grumbled. I don't think they heard you in Croatia.
Frank couldn't help grinning.
But coach, that's awesome. A little baby satyr? Or maybe a nymph? You'll be a fantastic dad.
Frank wasn't sure why he felt that way, considering the coach's love of baseball bats and roundhouse kicks. But he was sure. Coach Hedge scowled even deeper.
The war's coming, Zhang. Nowhere is safe. I should be there for Melly. If I gotta die somewhere...
Hey, nobody's going to die, Frank said.
Hedge met his eyes. Frank could tell the coach didn't believe it.
Always had a soft spot for children of Ares, Hedge muttered. Or Mars, whichever. Maybe that's why I'm not pulverizing you for asking so many questions.
But I wasn't...
Fine, I'll tell you.
Hedge sighed again.
Back when I was on my first assignment as a seeker, I was way out in Arizona. Brought in this kid named Clarice.
Clarice?
Sibling of yours, Hedge said. Ares kid. Violent. Rude. Lots of potential. Anyway, while I was out, I had this dream about my mom. She was a cloud nymph like Melly. I dreamed she was in trouble and needed my help right away. But I said to myself, nah, it's just a dream. Who would hurt a sweet old cloud nymph? Besides, I gotta get this Half-Blood to safety. So I finished my mission, brought Clarice to Camp Half-Blood. Afterward, I went looking for my mom. I was too late.
Frank watched the tuft of goat hair settle on top of a basketball.
What happened to her?
Hedge shrugged.
No idea. Never saw her again. Maybe if I'd been there for her, if I'd got back sooner.
Frank wanted to say something comforting, but he wasn't sure what. He had lost his mom in the war in Afghanistan, and he knew how empty the words, "I'm sorry," could sound.
"You were doing your job," Frank offered. "You saved a demigod's life."
Hedge grunted.
"Now my wife and my unborn kid are in danger, halfway across the world, and I can't do anything to help."
"You are doing something," Frank said. "We're over here to stop the giants from waking Gia. That's the best way we can keep our friends safe."
"Yeah. Yeah, I suppose."
Frank wished he could do more to lift Hedge's spirits, but this talk was making him worry about everyone he'd left behind. He wondered who was defending Camp Jupiter now that the Legion had marched east, especially with all the monsters Gia was unleashing from the doors of death. He worried about his friends in the 5th cohort and how they must be feeling as Octavian ordered them to march on Camp Half-Blood. Frank wanted to be back there, if only to stuff a teddy bear down the throat of that slime ball auger. The ship listed forward. The herd of sports equipment rolled under the coach's berth.
"We're descending," said Hedge. "We'd better get above."
"Yeah,"
Frank said, his voice hoarse.
"You're a nosy Roman, Zhang."
"But..."
"Come on," Hedge said. "And not a word about this to the others, you blabbermouth."
As the others made fast the aerial moorings, Leo grabbed Frank and Hazel by the arms. He dragged them to the aft ballista.
"Okay, here's the plan."
Hazel narrowed her eyes.
"I hate your plans." "I need that piece of magic firewood," Leo said. "Snappy."
Frank nearly choked on his own tongue. Hazel backed away, instinctively covering her coat pocket.
"Leo, you can't..."
"I found a solution."
Leo turned to Frank.
"It's your call, big guy, but I can protect you."
Frank thought about how many times he'd seen Leo's fingers burst into flame. One false move, and Leo could incinerate the piece of tinder that controlled Frank's life. But for some reason, Frank wasn't terrified. Since facing down the cow monsters in Venice, Frank had barely thought about his fragile lifeline. Yes, the smallest bit of fire might kill him, but he'd also survived some impossible things and made his dad proud. Frank had decided that whatever his fate was, he wouldn't worry about it. He would just do the best he could to help his friends. Besides, Leo sounded serious. His eyes were still full of that weird melancholy, like he was in two places at once, but nothing about his expression indicated any kind of joke.
"Go ahead, Hazel," Frank said.
"But..."
Hazel took a deep breath.
"Okay."
She took out the piece of firewood and handed it to Leo. In Leo's hands, it wasn't much bigger than a screwdriver. The tinder was still charred on one side, from where Frank had used it to burn through the icy chains that had imprisoned the god Thanatos in Alaska. From a pocket of his tool belt, Leo produced a piece of white cloth.
"Behold!"
Frank scowled.
"A handkerchief?"
"A surrender flag?"
Hazel guessed.
"No, unbelievers," Leo said. "This is a pouch woven from seriously cool fabric. A gift from a friend of mine."
Leo slipped the firewood into the pouch and pulled it closed with a tie of bronze thread.
"The drawstring was my idea," Leo said proudly. "It took some work lacing that into the fabric, but the pouch won't open unless you want it to. The fabric breathes just like regular cloth, so the firewood isn't any more sealed up than it would be in Hazel's coat pocket."
Hazel said.
"How is that an improvement, then?"
"Hold this so I don't give you a heart attack." Leo tossed the pouch to Frank, who almost fumbled it. Leo summoned a white-hot ball of fire into his right hand. He held his left forearm over the flames, grinning as they licked the sleeve of his jacket.
See? He said. It doesn't burn. Frank didn't like to argue with a guy who was holding a ball of fire, but he said, you're immune to flames. Leo rolled his eyes. Yeah, but I have to concentrate if I don't want my clothes to burn, and I'm not concentrating, see? This is totally fireproof cloth, which means your firewood won't burn in that pouch. Hazel looked unconvinced. How can you be sure?
Sheesh, tough audience.
Leo shut off the fire. Guess there's only one way to persuade you. He held out his hand to Frank.
No.
Frank backed off. Suddenly, all those brave thoughts about accepting his fate seemed far away.
That's okay, Leo. Thanks, but I can't.
Man, you gotta trust me. Frank's heart raced. Did he trust Leo? Well, sure, with an engine, with a practical joke, but with his life? He remembered the day they had gotten stuck in the underground workshop in Rome. Gia had promised they would die in that room. Leo had promised he would get Hazel and Frank out of the trap, and he'd done it. Now, Leo spoke with the same kind of confidence.
Okay.
Frank handed Leo the pouch.
Try not to kill me.
Leo's hand blazed. The pouch didn't blacken or burn. Frank waited for something to go horribly wrong. He counted to 20, but he was still alive. He felt as if a block of ice was melting just behind his sternum, a frozen chunk of fear he'd gotten so used to he didn't even think about it until it was gone. Leo extinguished his fire. He wriggled his eyebrows at Frank.
Who's your best buddy?
Don't answer that, Hazel said. But, Leo, that was amazing.
It was, wasn't it?
Leo agreed.
So, who wants to take this newly ultra-safe piece of firewood?
I'll keep it,
Frank said. Hazel pursed her lips. She looked down, maybe so Frank wouldn't see the hurt in her eyes. She'd protected that firewood for him through a lot of hard battles. It was a sign of trust between them, a symbol of their relationship.
Hazel, it's not about you,
Frank said as gently as he could.
I can't explain, but I have a feeling I'm going to need to step up when we're in the House of Hades. I need to carry my own burden.
Hazel's golden eyes were full of concern.
I understand. I worry.
Leo tossed Frank the pouch. Frank tied it around his belt. He felt strange carrying his fatal weakness so openly, after months of keeping it hidden.
And Leo, he said, thanks.
It seemed inadequate for the gift Leo had given him. But Leo grinned.
What are genius friends for?
Hey, guys, Piper called from the bow.
Better get over here. You need to see this.
They'd found the source of the dark lightning. The Argo II hovered directly over the river. A few hundred meters away, at the top of the nearest hill, stood a cluster of ruins. They didn't look like much. Just some crumbling walls encircling the limestone shells of a few buildings. But from somewhere within the ruins, tendrils of black ether curled into the sky, like a smoky squid peeking from its cave. As Frank watched, a bolt of dark energy ripped through the air, rocking the ship and sending a cold shockwave across the landscape.
The Necromantion, Nico said. The House of Hades.
Frank steadied himself at the rail. He supposed it was too late to suggest turning back. He was starting to feel nostalgic about the monsters he'd fought in Rome. Heck, chasing poison cows through Venice had been more appealing than this place. Piper hugged her arms.
I feel vulnerable floating up here like this. Couldn't we set down in the river?
I wouldn't,
Hazel said. That's the River Acheron. Jason squinted in the sunlight. I thought the Acheron was in the underworld. It is, Hazel said, but its headwaters are in the mortal world. That river below us, eventually it flows underground, straight into the realm of Pluto, Hades. Landing a demigod ship on those waters. Yeah, let's stay up here, Leo decided. I don't want any zombie water on my hole. Half a kilometer downstream, some fishing boats were puttering along. Frank guessed they didn't know or care about the history of this river. Must be nice, being a regular mortal. Next to Frank, Nico D'Angelo raised the scepter of Diocletian. Its orb glowed with purple light, as if in sympathy with the dark storm. Roman relic or not, the scepter troubled Frank. If it really had the power to summon a legion of the dead, well, Frank wasn't sure that was such a great idea. Jason had once told him that the children of Mars had a similar ability. Supposedly, Frank could call on ghostly soldiers from the losing side of any war to serve him. He'd never had much luck with that power, probably because it freaked him out too much. He was worried he might become one of those ghosts if they lost this war, eternally doomed to pay for his failures, assuming there was anyone left to summon him.
So, Nico,
Frank gestured at the scepter.
Have you learned to use that thing?
We'll find out.
Nico stared at the tendrils of darkness undulating from the ruins.
I don't intend to try until I have to. The doors of death are already working overtime bringing in Gia's monsters. Any more activity raising the dead, and the doors might shatter permanently, leaving a rip in the mortal world that can't be closed.
Coach Hedge grunted.
I hate rips in the world. Let's go bust some monster heads.
Frank looked at the satyr's grim expression. Suddenly, he had an idea.
Coach, you should stay on board. Cover us with the ballistae.
Hedge frowned.
Stay behind? Me? I'm your best soldier.
We might need air support, Frank said, like we did in Rome. You saved our brachy.
He didn't add, plus, I'd like you to get back to your wife and baby alive. Hedge apparently got the message. His scowl relaxed. Relief showed in his eyes.
Well, he grumbled, I suppose somebody's gotta save your bracky.
Jason clapped the coach on the shoulder. Then he gave Frank an appreciative nod.
So that's settled. Everybody else, let's get to the ruins. Time to crash Gia's party.
Chapter 66. Frank. Despite the midday heat and the raging storm of death energy, a group of tourists was climbing over the ruins. Fortunately, there weren't many, and they didn't give the demigods a second look. After the crowds in Rome, Frank had stopped worrying too much about getting noticed. If they could fly their warship into the Roman Colosseum with ballistae blazing and not even cause a traffic slowdown, he figured they could get away with anything. Nico led the way. At the top of the hill, they climbed over an old retaining wall and down into an excavated trench. Finally, they arrived at a stone doorway leading straight into the side of the hill. The death storm seemed to originate right above their heads. Looking up at the swirling tentacles of darkness, Frank felt like he was trapped at the bottom of a flushing toilet bowl. That really didn't calm his nerves. Nico faced the group.
From here it gets tough.
Sweet, Leo said, 'cause so far I've totally been pulling my punches.
Nico glared at him.
We'll see how long you keep your sense of humor. Remember, this is where pilgrims came to commune with dead ancestors. Underground, you may see things that are hard to look at, or hear voices trying to lead you astray in the tunnels. Frank, do you have the barley cakes?
What?
Frank had been thinking about his grandmother and his mom, wondering if they might appear to him. For the first time in days, the voices of Ares and Mars had started to argue again in the back of Frank's mind, debating their favorite forms of violent death.
"I've got the cakes," Hazel said.
She pulled out the magical barley crackers they'd made from the grain Triptolemus had given them in Venice.
"Eat up," Nico advised.
Frank chewed his cracker of death and tried not to gag. It reminded him of a cookie made with sawdust instead of sugar.
"Yum," Piper said. Even the daughter of Aphrodite couldn't avoid making a face.
"Okay."
Nico choked down the last of his barley.
"That should protect us from the poison."
"Poison?" Leo asked. "Did I miss the poison? 'Cause I love poison."
"Soon enough," Nico promised. "Just stick close together and maybe we can avoid getting lost or going insane."
On that happy note, Nico led them underground. The tunnel spiraled gently downward, the ceiling supported by white stone arches that reminded Frank of a whale's ribcage. As they walked, Hazel ran her hands along the masonry.
"This wasn't part of a temple," she whispered. "This was the basement for a manor house, built in later Greek times."
Frank found it eerie how Hazel could tell so much about an underground place just by being there. He'd never known her to be mistaken.
"A manor house?" he asked. "Please don't tell me we're in the wrong place."
"The House of Hades is below us," Nico assured him. "But Hazel's right. These upper levels are much newer. When the archaeologists first excavated this site, they thought they'd found the Necromantion. Then they realized the ruins were too recent, so they decided it was the wrong spot. They were right the first time. They just didn't dig deep enough."
They turned a corner and stopped. In front of them, the tunnel ended in a huge block of stone.
"A cave-in?" Jason asked.
"A test," Nico said. "Hazel, would you do the honors?"
Hazel stepped forward. She placed her hand on the rock and the entire boulder crumbled to dust. The tunnel shuddered. Cracks spread across the ceiling. For a terrifying moment, Frank imagined they'd all be crushed under tons of earth. A disappointing way to die after all they'd been through. Then the rumbling stopped. The dust settled. A set of stairs curved deeper into the earth, the barreled ceiling held up by more repeating arches, closer together and carved from polished black stone. The descending arches made Frank feel dizzy, as if he were looking into an endlessly reflecting mirror. Painted on the walls were crude pictures of black cattle marching downward.
"I really don't like cows," Piper muttered.
"Agreed,"
Frank said.
"Those are the cattle of Hades," Nico said. "It's just a symbol of..."
"Look,"
Frank pointed. On the first step of the stairwell, a golden chalice gleamed. Frank was pretty sure it hadn't been there a moment before. The cup was full of dark green liquid.
"Hooray," Leo said half-heartedly. "I suppose that's our poison."
Nico picked up the chalice.
"We're standing at the ancient entrance of the Necromantion. Odysseus came here, and dozens of other heroes, seeking advice from the dead."
"Did the dead advise them to leave immediately?" Leo asked.
"I would be fine with that," Piper admitted. Nico drank from the chalice, then offered it to Jason.
"You asked me about trust and taking a risk? Well, here you go, son of Jupiter. How much do you trust me?"
Frank wasn't sure what Nico was talking about, but Jason didn't hesitate. He took the cup and drank. They passed it around, each taking a sip of poison. As he waited his turn, Frank tried to keep his legs from shaking and his gut from churning. He wondered what his grandmother would say if she could see him.
Stupid Fai Zhang,
she would probably scold.
If all your friends were drinking poison, would you do it too?
Frank went last. The taste of the green liquid reminded him of spoiled apple juice. He drained the chalice. It turned to smoke in his hands. Nico nodded, apparently satisfied.
Congratulations. Assuming the poison doesn't kill us, we should be able to find our way through the Necromantion's first level.
Just the first level? Piper asked. Nico turned to Hazel and gestured at the stairs.
After you, sister.
In no time, Frank felt completely lost. The stairs split in three different directions. As soon as Hazel chose a path, the stairs split again. They wound their way through interconnecting tunnels and rough-hewn burial chambers that all looked the same. The walls carved with dusty niches that might once have held bodies. The arches over the doors were painted with black cows, white poplar trees, and owls.
I thought the owl was Minerva's symbol, Jason murmured.
The screech owl is one of Hades' sacred animals, Nico said. Its cry is a bad omen.
This way.
Hazel pointed to a doorway that looked the same as all the others.
It's the only one that won't collapse on us.
Good choice, then, Leo said. Frank began to feel like he was leaving the world of the living. His skin tingled, and he wondered if it was a side effect of the poison. The pouch with his firewood seemed heavier on his belt. In the eerie glow of their magic weapons, his friends looked like flickering ghosts. Cold air brushed against his face. In his mind, Ares and Mars had gone silent, but Frank thought he heard other voices whispering in the side corridors, beckoning him to veer off course, to come closer and listen to them speak. Finally, they reached an archway carved in the shape of human skulls. Or maybe they were human skulls embedded in the rock. In the purple light of Diocletian's scepter, the hollow eye sockets seemed to blink. Frank almost hit the ceiling when Hazel put a hand on his arm.
This is the entrance to the second level, she said. I'd better take a look.
Frank hadn't even realized that he'd moved in front of the doorway.
Yeah.
He made way for her. Hazel traced her fingers across the carved skulls.
No traps on the doorway, but something is strange here. My underground sense is fuzzy, like someone is working against me, hiding what's ahead of us.
The sorceress that Hecate warned you about? Jason guessed. The one Leo saw in his dream? What was her name?
Hazel chewed her lip.
It would be safer not to say her name, but stay alert. One thing I'm sure of, from this point on, the dead are stronger than the living.
Frank wasn't sure how she knew that, but he believed her. The voices in the darkness seemed to whisper louder. He caught glimpses of movement in the shadows. From the way his friend's eyes darted around, he guessed they were seeing things too.
Where are the monsters?
He wondered aloud.
I thought Gia had an army guarding the doors.
Don't know, Jason said. His pale skin looked as green as the poison from the chalice.
At this point, I'd almost prefer a straight-up fight.
Careful what you wish for, man.
Leo summoned a ball of fire to his hand, and for once, Frank was glad to see the flames.
Personally, I'm hoping nobody's home. We walk in, find Percy and Annabeth, destroy the doors of death, and walk out. Maybe stop at the gift shop.
Yeah,
Frank said.
That'll happen.
The tunnel shook. Rubble rained down from the ceiling. Hazel grabbed Frank's hand.
That was close, she muttered. These passageways won't take much more.
The doors of death just opened again, Nico said.
It's happening like every 15 minutes, Piper noted.
Every 12,
Nico corrected, though he didn't explain how he knew.
We'd better hurry. Percy and Annabeth are close. They're in danger. I can sense it.
As they traveled deeper, the corridors widened. The ceilings rose to 6 meters high, decorated with elaborate paintings of owls in the branches of white poplars. The extra space should have made Frank feel better, but all he could think about was the tactical situation. The tunnels were big enough to accommodate large monsters, even giants. There were blind corners everywhere, perfect for ambushes. Their group could be flanked or surrounded easily. They would have no good options for retreat. All of Frank's instincts told him to get out of these tunnels. If no monsters were visible, that just meant they were hiding, waiting to spring a trap. Even though Frank knew that, there wasn't much he could do about it. They had to find the doors of death. Leo held his fire close to the walls. Frank saw ancient Greek graffiti scratched into the stone. He couldn't read ancient Greek, but he guessed they were prayers or supplications to the dead, written by pilgrims thousands of years ago. The tunnel floor was littered with ceramic shards and silver coins.
Offerings? Piper guessed.
Yes, Nico said. If you wanted your ancestors to appear, you had to make an offering.
Let's not make an offering, Jason suggested. Nobody argued.
The tunnel from here is unstable, Hazel warned. The floor might... Well, just follow me. Step exactly where I step.
She made her way forward. Frank walked right behind her, not because he felt particularly brave, but because he wanted to be close if Hazel needed his help. The voices of the war god were arguing again in his ears. He could sense danger, very close now.
Fai Zhang.
He stopped cold. That voice, it wasn't Ares or Mars. It seemed to come from right next to him, like someone whispering in his ear.
Frank?
Jason whispered behind him.
Hazel, hold up a second. Frank, what's wrong?
Nothing,
Frank murmured.
I just...
Pylos, the voice said. I await you in Pylos.
Frank felt like the poison was bubbling back up his throat. He'd been scared plenty of times before. He'd even faced the god of death. But this voice terrified him in a different way. It resonated right down to his bones, as if it knew everything about him. His curse, his history, his future. His grandmother had always been big on honoring the ancestors. It was a Chinese thing. You had to appease ghosts. You had to take them seriously. Frank always thought his grandmother's superstitions were silly. Now he changed his mind. He had no doubt. The voice that spoke to him was one of his ancestors.
Frank, don't move.
Hazel sounded alarmed. He looked down and realized he'd been about to step out of line.
To survive, you must lead, the voice said. At the break, you must take charge.
Lead where?
He asked aloud. Then the voice was gone. Frank could feel its absence, as if the humidity had suddenly dropped.
Big guy?
Leo said.
Could you not freak out on us? Please and thank you?
Frank's friends were all looking at him with concern.
I'm okay, he managed. Just a voice.
Nico nodded.
I did warn you. It'll only get worse. We should...
Hazel held up her hand for silence.
Wait here, everybody.
Frank didn't like it, but she forged ahead alone. He counted to 23 before she came back, her face drawn and pensive.
Scary room ahead, she warned. Don't panic.
Those two things don't go together, Leo murmured. But they followed Hazel into the cavern. The place was like a circular cathedral.